Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this live program. I am Carolyn Yeager, your host, and I have an excellent show for you tonight, as usual. I always try to, but sometimes I'm more confident in the beginning, and this time I am. So I hope you will stay with me for the whole show, because there's a lot to be covered, a lot that's going to be going on. Now, the Heretics Hour is not noting that today is MLK Day. We don't deal in the ridiculous and politically correct here. We are noting that today is 4 days away from the 70th anniversary of the alleged conference at the Wannsee or Wannsee Villa outside of Berlin, at which the final solution of the German Jewish problem was decided. Yes, on January 20th, 1942. It is said. Notice I said the alleged conference. We always have to pay attention to whether that word is used or not. We'll be going into this entire story with Christine Miller, who will join me in the second hour. And I'm going to begin in the second segment with an article by Paul Gottfried after I do my reading from the fire in this first segment. I will not forego that because I consider it very important to our proper understanding of the period in question. Now, again, this book is by Jörg Friedrich. It is called The Fire, with the subtitle The Bombing of Germany in 1940-1945. I'm going to begin tonight on page 42, and I'll read just a little bit about the anti-aircraft flak defense and then about the German fighter planes and the British bomber crews. And that will take me to the end of the first chapter, which is titled Weapon. And then I'll see how that goes, and then we'll start with chapter two. So, to change my reading glasses, and for the most part, larger formations of bombers demanded larger batteries of anti-aircraft artillery, and vice versa. This did not affect the loss percentage, but it was the theatrical element that counted, and Hitler and the Gauleiters continually pressed to set up fighter and flak defenses in the cities. The bombing war was about enduring the death of others. The next time it will be me. It was a performance geared to inner experiences. Corpses cannot surrender, only people who do not want to die. The air drama of the flak was similar. The urban residents saw it not as a massacre, but as a battle taking place, and so did the flyers. Now, here's a quote from a British flyer. Suddenly, your own little bit of sanctuary in the sky where you thought you were safely hidden was engulfed in brilliant and dazzling light, wrote Sergeant G.K. Powell of No. 102 Squadron RAF. The following is a short quote from Air Battle of the Ruhr by someone named Cooper, obviously a British person. The aircraft was caught like a fly in a net, trying desperately to extricate itself before the gunners could get a bearing on it. Not many survived such attention from searchlights and flak. The only hope was to get clear before the searchlights could form a cone. On a number of occasions, I observed bombers held in cones of searchlights and watched helplessly as the shell bursts got nearer the aircraft until suddenly flames appeared and sometimes a violent explosion, unquote. Lieutenant R.B. Lay of No. 156 Squadron RAF remembered the mere sight of the flak searchlights surrounding Berlin in rings as, quote, probably the most frightening experience of my lifetime, unquote. As a bombardier lying on his stomach in the nose of the Lancaster in the final approach of a seemingly endless run-up, he saw the city bristling with its flak cannons and awaited instructions from the master bomber who, before the release, would order them to fly straight and level, not to dive away. And he expected to be blown to pieces. The pilot might instead evade the searchlights out of fear and let the vibrating, howling aircraft drop 6,000 or 7,000 feet. That tore at his ears, but saved him from the fate that Wing Commander D.H. Burnside ordered his crew from number 427 Squadron into over Essen. There, Wellingtons flew straight into the flak grenades. Shrapnel killed the navigator instantly. The radio operator lost one of his feet, and the load was released. At times, half the Wellingtons did not return from their missions because they lacked self-sealing fuel tanks and thus caught fire immediately. The crews of such older planes were literally flying in their coffins. For the destruction of Berlin, the heavy Stirlings and Halifaxes were called in once again to carry the tonnage needed for the big city. The Halifaxes clattered around relatively low without the option of escaping into a higher altitude when the Hunters attacked. I'm going to stop with that and go on to the next page, and gets into the German fighter planes and then the British bomber crews. By the summer of 1943, the fighter pilots, meaning the German fighter pilots, knew what the city they were flying over would look like an hour later on the ground. They pitted themselves against squadrons who made pyres out of cities whose names meant something to them. Aachen, Münster, Nuremberg. The Luftwaffe put a company of problem cases in charge of the Wild Boar. That was the name of the company. Social misfits, disciplinary cases, old war horses, people who had nothing to lose and who fought their final battle above the city. The tactics of Tame Boar, introduced in January 1944, on the other hand, involved lining the approach route and the way home. The fighter planes followed the bomber stream, threaded themselves in, overtook their victims, turned around, and raced into them in a frontal attack, firing in the split second before a collision, then going into a steep climb. It forced the bombers to be concerned more with their own survival than with bombardment. Bomber Command assigned a series of 30 missions to their crews. In 1943, there was a 1 in 6 chance of coming out alive. 1 in 6 chance of coming out alive. Notice, not 1 in 6 chance of not coming out alive. In November, 20% made it. In statistical terms, a loss rate of 3.3% per raid meant that 2/3 would not survive the 30 missions. The crews became fatalists. Either you made it or you didn't. You could improve your odds by staying awake and keeping in contact with one another in order to react quickly if a battle situation suddenly developed. But just as helpful were lucky charms or urinating together against the back wheel before takeoff and upon return as thanks for an extension of your stay in this world. The boyish candidates who went on their 30 sorties because they were adventurous and were told that Bomber Command would win the war soon had incredible horror stamped onto their features. 100 silent men walked to takeoff with lips tightly pressed. You could not give up a tour without looking like a weakling and letting down your buddies. In the face of direct death, there seemed not to be any sensibility for the indirect death in the bomb bay. That is what they were carrying with them to do to other people. Releasing the bombs did not stir up any feelings of uneasiness. The missions included a handful of ironclad truths. This is what they were told by their leaders. The Germans were the first to kill civilians in London, Birmingham, and Sheffield. That's not true, but they tormented residents in the areas they occupied. Not true either. Bombing saved the bloodshed that ground operations would bring, and it shortened the duration of the war. Worrisome words were avoided during briefings prior to takeoff. A participant in the attack on Essen, which was a particularly terrible devastation of Essen, a participant in this attack on July 25th and 26th, 1943, reported years later, quote, "At that point, we were not aware that we were bombing civilians as such because we had always been given an aiming point like the docks or a rubber factory or railway yards. But on this occasion, the briefing said that they were to bomb the workers' houses or residential quarters, and this came as something of a personal shock," unquote. Pilots and navigators who had entered into their logbooks a season earlier that they left the burning city of Essen as, quote, an immense pot boiling over, unquote, whose glow of the fires looked like a red sunset even 150 miles away, did not have to be told about the havoc their weapons had wrought down on the ground. But their look back could not be separated from their relief at having escaped the 2,000 flak artillery that surrounded Essen, which would be remembered as the best defended city of all. Sometimes discontent welled up. The number 76 squadron stationed in Yorkshire had misgivings about the mission to Wuppertal because it would hit thousands of evacuees who had fled there after having been bombed out of cities in the Ruhr Basin. Such objections were always appeased with reference to the military targets. And there were, in fact, two textile factories in Wuppertal that produced fabric for parachutes. The navigators remarked during the briefing, quote, women and children first again, unquote, was studiously ignored, yet it sank in. After their mission, the bomber crews returned to their home bases in quiet garrison towns and villages where the residents were warm-hearted and well-disposed toward the airmen. Landing, of all things, turned out to be a hurdle many of them failed to clear. Overcome with fatigue and fear, with empty fuel tanks, in foggy, overcrowded airspace, many of the returning soldiers were killed in a crash landing after all they had already gone through. Lying awake at night, they brooded over what had happened. The stress of the battle had faded. The cohesion of the crew that held during the mission was interrupted for a short moment, and the navigators and bombardiers turned into young boys, imagining what it now looked like miles below their battlefield. The target photographs were evaluated as soon as the flyers returned, so crews that knew nothing about what they had fought so hard for could get an idea of their accomplishments. At night, this idea became filled with emotion. According to surveys, three-quarters of the bomber crews felt no animosity whatsoever toward the German civilian population. Excuse me, I'm going to get some water. Or at least no more than that expressed by the empty beer bottles they dropped with the bombs as a sign of disrespect. The 500 Essen inhabitants who had been mutilated and burned on the night of July 25th were also by no means too abstract to imagine. It had been the sixth operation over Essen since March, and reports were full of clouds of smoke that rose to 20,000 feet and the panorama of fire across the city, which was the most impressive ever seen. A pathfinder who in retrospect claimed to have had considerable qualms about bombing women, children in hospitals, afterwards fittingly asked, quote, but to whom could you express such doubts? If we believed it morally wrong, we should have spoken out to our squadron commanders and refused to participate. What would have been the result? Court-martial, he says. Well, the Nuremberg, this is my comment now, I can't resist, because the Nuremberg verdicts were certainly full of the idea that these soldiers who followed orders that were somehow, not legal, according to the courts, that was no excuse for them, but it is an excuse for all the Allied soldiers. It is true, though, when you're a soldier, you follow orders, that's what you do, and you can't do anything else. Thoughts about legal consequences remained in the subjunctive mood and went on ad absurdum. The military court punished the legal conscience. A totally acceptable reluctance, on the other hand, was asserted by a master bomber of the attack on Dresden, when 3 months earlier, he was ordered to lead the attack on Freiburg. He had studied at the University of Freiburg and had many friends who lived around the cathedral, which had been selected as the orientation point for the bombardment. He refused to lead the mission, which everyone could understand. But he had never been to Dresden, and though he regretted the destruction of such a beautiful city, he carried it out, he carried the mission out because he lacked any personal reasons not to. You know, I want to comment here. This is the end of chapter one. I want to comment that I think the numbers that are used in this book by this author are on the low side for sure. He's using the official numbers. He has his places where he is anti-National Socialist and anti-Hitler and so on, but he's writing for the German people, in Germany, not for the National Socialist regime. So he's not, he's going along with the official, reports in every way. So just keep that in mind. Now, chapter two is, called Strategy. And it starts with a short quote from Winston Churchill. Churchill said, "Some are curable and others killable," whatever he was referring to. But I'm not going to read the little intro here. I'm just going to go straight into the story and start right at the beginning of this chapter. The percentage of the air crews who lost their lives exceeded by far the loss ratio of the targets of their attacks. A bomber commands 125,000 crew members. There were 55,000 casualties, or 44%. The number, now that's a high percent. The number of people they killed is uncertain. Figures vary between 420,000 and 570,000. That's, I think, too low, but they would represent roughly 1.5% of the urban population. Such a comparison makes no sense, of course, because the crews died in combat with military adversaries, the fighters in the flak. The troops were mustered either voluntarily or by conscription according to the customs of war. The residents of the towns and cities were fighting for their survival, but they fought against no one. They were neither willing nor equipped to do so, and up to that time, no custom of war confronted them with the force of arms. The decision to use the unprecedented and unusual tactic of bombing cities and civilians was made by a small number of men, but not in secret. The means deployed during World War II were approved on all sides by the people, parliaments, and armed forces. Everyone thought that what was done was right. Neither German nor British nor American civilian populations disapproved of the deliberate attack of enemy civilians. Such actions were expected throughout the world, and self-protection was drilled extensively. Cellars, gas masks, sirens, blackouts, and fire-extinguishing drills were emergency procedures familiar to millions and millions of Europeans. They were described in detail in everything from light fiction to military doctrine. This is why, regarding the hell whose arrival had been anticipated for 20 years, it is less surprising that it finally broke out at all than that it confronted such extensive material difficulties. It was supposed to be much easier. I'm going to skip a few paragraphs and start here. In earlier times, cities would have been besieged and hammered with artillery fire, as General Moltke did in Paris, that's a German general, in 1870 during the Franco-Prussian War. Strategic bombing was something truly different. It aimed to win the entire war from the air. Winston Churchill pioneered this concept. When he was Minister of Munitions, he had planned a 1,000 bomber attack on Berlin for 1919. If the Germans had held their Western Front in 1918, a new front would have opened up there, which would have been decisive for the war. He wrote this in 1925, evidently relieved that it had not been necessary. Quote, "The campaign of 1919 was never fought, but its ideas go moving along," unquote. The use of the air made it possible that, quote, "death and terror could be carried far beyond the lines of the actual armies to women, children, the aged, the sick, who in earlier struggles would perforce have been left untouched," unquote. For the first time, one group of civilized men was afforded the opportunity of reducing their opponents to absolute helplessness. Helplessness meant being completely at the mercy of the bomb. The 49-year-old Churchill added to the catalog of vulnerabilities imaginary weapons that scientists were only gradually starting to conceive. Quote from Churchill, "Might not a bomb no bigger than an orange be found to possess a secret power to destroy a whole block of buildings? Nay, to concentrate the force of 1,000 tons of cordite and blast a township at a stroke?" Unquote. "An enemy city might be hit hard by flying objects without a human pilot, or by methodically, we have that, of course, now, by methodically prepared plague, anthrax, and smallpox viruses. If only one of the warring parties were equipped with this, it could enslave the others. And if all sides had access, the result would be the ruin of the world. War, unfortunately, stands, quote, ready if called on to pulverize what is left of civilization, unquote. Just got a few minutes left here. The trials carried out during World War I demonstrated not the possibility, but the impossibility of achieving anything even remotely resembling total destruction. On January 19, 1915, German Zeppelins dropped explosives along the Norfolk coast wherever they perceived clusters of lights. They thereby killed 2 men and 2 women and injured 16 others. In the course of the year, they returned 19 times and killed a total of 498 civilians and 58 military personnel. London was hit for the first time on the night of May 30th. This had been still back in World War I. And 7 were killed. At least I think that's what he means. Doesn't? Yes. Twin-engine Gothas and 4-engine Riesen, or Giants, continued the attack in 1917 and 1918, killing 836 and injuring 1,994. Half the planes which flew day raids failed to find London. 1 in 5 was shot down. British reprisal in 1918 killed 746 Germans and injured 1,843. All of these deaths by bombing amounted to just a fraction of the annual number of traffic deaths. Churchill's results were even more modest. On the night of August 25th, 1940, his long-contemplated Berlin plan was carried out. Because he did not have 1,000 bombers at his disposal, he sent 50 Hamptons with a P, and Wellingtons. They faced strong headwinds, which required more fuel than had been provided for. Consequently, 3 planes went down, and 3 others crashed into the North Sea on their return trip. With that, a 12% of the expedition corps had been lost. The Germans lost a wooden shack in the town of Rosenthal, and 2 people were slightly injured. Churchill had personally ordered Bomber Command to execute the operation as a heavy attack. The impetus for the attack was a trifle that was given 2 lines in the diary of Churchill's private secretary, John Colville. He wrote, "Monday, August 26th, London has been bombed by a single aircraft on Saturday night." That's the end of that. It later turned out that there had been 12 planes that had gotten lost and, contrary to orders from Hitler and Goering, had dropped a couple of bombs on docks, thereby causing very minor damage. That was how the Times reported it on Monday. "And in retaliation," noted Colville, "we sent 89 bombers over Berlin last night." Bomber Command's report on Churchill's telephone order said, quote, "He wished us to be fully prepared and hoped we had adequate resources in the bag and that there would be no difficulties. He felt that it was no good tackling this job with small forces and was averse to administering pinpricks," unquote. Chief of Air Staff Sir Cyril Newell had not been prepared for such an operation, especially since the weather was unfavorable. Anyway, an attack on Leipzig was being organized. Newell gave orders to go ahead with everything as planned, with the provision to avoid indiscriminate bombing of the civil population. But Arthur Harris, then Air Vice Marshal in Bomber Command, convinced Newell to follow the wishes of the Prime Minister. It was a unique opportunity for retribution, according to Harris, that would not come again very soon. In fact, however, the attack was hardly noticed in Berlin. "Enemy aircraft over Berlin," wrote Goebbels in his diary. "Several hours of air raid alarm. We observed the major flak barrage, a majestic spectacle." But other than that, he was more concerned about the U.S. presidential elections that November. Goebbels wrote, "America fluctuates between resignation and military intervention. If Roosevelt is reelected, the United States will certainly enter the war." Now that's the end of Goebbels. For the meantime, though, the weather was more important. Continuing with Goebbels, "Perhaps it will finally improve and give our Luftwaffe its much-longed-for opportunity for a major raid." France surrendered on June 22, 1940. England fled the continent, leaving its ordnance at the Channel ports. Only the troops, without their arms, could be evacuated. And yet Churchill refused to make peace with Hitler. His last remaining weapons were the fleets, both sea and air. The Germans decided to attempt landing on the island, and they also bombarded the coastal defenses, harbors, airports, and military airfields. Only Britain's fighter command could stop them. It cannot win the war, as Churchill declared, but it can definitely lose it. If the fighter force was worn down by the attackers, the only remaining option would be for the Navy to escape by sea, leaving England defenseless. The Germans who wanted to land could take the ferry. So Churchill swore to soften up British beaches with mustard gas in such a case. In the course of the August battle, 1943, the Luftwaffe shot down almost twice as many British airplanes as it lost its. But the Germans were not able to break the bitter resistance. Oh, well, here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, when I get back, I will have be discussing a couple of things having to do with the WANSEE conference and other things. And so do stay tuned.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
America's mainstream media is being accused of playing with fire for playing up the prospect of war between Iran and the West. It's a sensitive time with the military standoff in the Strait of Hormuz and looming sanctions over Iran's nuclear program. But as Ghani Chichikan reports, viewers in the States are repeatedly hearing how war is virtually inescapable.
It's really two options. Bomb Iran or let Iran get the bomb.
With tension between Iran and the West as high as ever, a host of hardline speakers on U.S. mainstream media seem to be pushing the audience to believe that war is inevitable.
The better way to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons is to attack its nuclear weapons program directly.
Although experts say war with Iran is far from being inevitable.
I don't think that we are there yet, that is to say, at the precipice.
The media are already preparing the grounds for it, some by misinforming the public. The New York Times wrote that the International Atomic Energy Agency said Iran's nuclear program has a military objective. But that's not what the IAEA reported. The watchdog said Iran might have the technology to develop a nuclear weapon if it wants to. Or here is another public misconception due to a lack of information.
I would be saying to the Iranians, you either open up those facilities, you begin to dismantle them and make them available to inspectors, or we will degrade those facilities through airstrike.
In fact, IAEA inspectors have already been in the country monitoring Iran's nuclear facilities.
When the American people hear information over and over again, and sometimes it is often these subtleties, you know, not providing the context of the IAEA report, or not putting in some of the doubts back in 2002, 2003 about the Iraqi WMD programs, that kind of slanting of the news does have the effect of altering how the American public views an issue.
The U.S. mainstream media have proved to be cheerleaders for war. Jeff Cohen was a senior producer of a popular TV show before the Iraq invasion. He says they were under pressure from their bosses to root for war because their owners benefited from it.
It was a constant pressure campaign to make sure that the pro-invasion voice was dominant.
Jeff Cohen says not much has changed in U.S. mainstream journalism since the Iraq invasion.
There's no doubt that the mainstream media are crucial in this idea of selling this idea that the U.S. is going to be in a perpetual war.
Media analysts say since the intervention in Libya, U.S. media have been instrumental in making Americans get used to the idea that Washington will continue to intervene militarily in foreign affairs.
I worked at Newsweek and as well as AP and other major U.S. news organizations. And what I saw, especially at a place like Newsweek, was this idea that
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and before I begin on the main subject, I want to bring your attention to a newsletter put out by a friend of mine, Jim Lowe of Fredericksburg, Texas. This will just be a short detour, but one that I think you will enjoy. His newsletter is titled FLAK, F-L-A-K, exclamation mark, and it's only in print, not online. It comes in the mail. Jim circulated a 16-page monthly newsletter called Parish Notes for many years, and I actually have talked about it in some of my early shows, but read some things from it. But he sent this went to people all over the United States and elsewhere, I imagine. But now he's down to the 4-page FLAK, which comes out weekly. The point of all this is that Jim is just a darn good writer, no matter what he's writing about, which tends to be a little bit of everything, but much that's in the area of the Germanic interest to people who are Germanophiles. And that's why I send occasional donations to cover the postage for mailing. To get on his mailing list, write to Jim Lowe, L-O-W-E, 707 North Bowie, or Bowie, B-O-W-I-E, Fredericksburg, F-R-E-D-R-I-C-K-S-B-E-R-G, although he always spells it in the German fashion, 78624, no emails. Jim puts small ads in his newsletter for businesses and programs he likes, and he has now designed and added one for VOR and the Heretics Hour. I suggested that to him, and he's already sent me the proof of it, and it's going to go in the next issue. So, and it probably will stay there for a while. So this came about, though, because I called him about his ad for the Alex Jones show, which he can hear and the people of Fredericksburg can hear on the actual radio for 2 hours on Sunday afternoon coming from an Austin station. Other readers may have questioned him advertising about why he advertises Alex Jones, because he wrote a short essay underneath the ad in the January 6th FLAK, which I'm going to read. Of course, essay is a lot bigger space than the little ad, but here it is. Editor's note. The ad above is run because for nearly a decade now, I found the very provocative Mr. Jones stimulative of thought concerning issues of the day. But in his exuberance, the boisterous boy of Austin Radio sometimes errs when it comes to little details of history. For example, this past Sunday, he declared that Germany had invaded France in the name of German security, the distinct connotation being that Germany was an aggressor. Fact is that those two countries were at peace on September 2, 1939, when the next day France declared war on Germany. The Vaterland had not made a single aggressive move against its Gallic neighbor. Then Germany gave the French a full half year of what became dubbed the Phony War to retract that bellicose declaration. Only in June of 1940 did the Wehrmacht finally terminate the hostilities declared by France after its surgical sweep lasting mere weeks that culminated in a victory parade through the Arc de Triomphe, the beautiful city of Paris, still intact, spared bombardment, and toured afterward by the German head of state who visited the Opera House and even paid homage at the tomb of Napoleon. This left only cigar-chomping Churchill to be pacified. Tragically, the British saber-rattlers, who had dragged reluctant France into their war against the more prosperous Reich, succeeded in drawing America into the conflict by withholding intercepted Japanese transmissions from Washington, keeping us from preventing an attack on our fleet at Pearl Harbor. That British-initiated war declaration of September 3, 1939, turned an isolated Central European conflict between Germany and Poland into a wider European war. Although the hostilities extended to British and French colonies abroad, it was on December 7, 1941, that we got a full-blown global shootout. Pearl and its people were savaged. England got blitzed. German cities and their inhabitants were burnt to cinders in firestorms, lit by incendiary bombs. Japanese were vaporized by nukes. Stalin genocided Prussia and enslaved half of Europe. The British lost their empire, and millions of Americans suffered the loss of sons, brothers, uncles, nephews, fathers, sweethearts, and husbands. All for London's 9339. And then he puts in parentheses, any significance in that being a palindrome? Either way you read it, it marks the beginning of what became the Second World War. Interesting that it is 9339 when you write it as you would write the 9/11/01. And backwards, it's also 933. Did I say that? 9339, frontwards and backwards. Alex Jones has, on occasion, claimed to have read a lot of history. Given his excited delivery at the microphone, slips of the tongue are perhaps understandable. But his words need sometimes to be taken with a grain of salt, especially when he tries to make a point by manufacturing a history of his own. Or, more likely, the broadcaster simply parrots a politically correct tale manufactured by the ultimate, if transitory, monetary and political beneficiaries of that global Holocaust, in which some 140 million Christians, Buddhists, Shintoists, Mohammedans, even atheists, and others perished. He finally says, interesting show, though, and much therein to ponder, hence the ad. Well, Jim, I have to say that I don't find it so interesting, but since you don't have the internet, that's something of the best that you can do. You can find. All right. If you want to know more about, if you didn't catch all that about Jim's address and information and so on, you can always write to me at carolyn@carolynyeager.com and get the information. Now, as I promised, I'm going to begin with an article in this segment by Paul Gottfried, who is Jewish. Many of you are familiar with him, I'm sure. He is a favorite among many in the pro-white circles, even though he's not white. I mean that he's not even a light-skinned, light-eyed Jew, but a swarthy Jew. But he is a paleo-conservative in good standing, and I must admit he has a pleasing way about him. I've listened to him myself and enjoyed him. However, he has written this article, which someone sent around, and I saw it's at Taki's Magazine website. It's titled The Eternal German Guilt Trip. It was posted on January 11th at Taki's. It's based on a new book written by Alfred de Zayas, who is Cuban by birth, but Europeanized by education. De Zayas is a formidable intellect and man of culture. He is a lover of German culture in particular. He currently lives in Switzerland. I believe he does, last I knew. Over the years, he has done important research into the brutal expulsion of the German-speaking people from Prussia, Silesia, and the Sudetenland, also from Yugoslavia and even Russia, and written excellent, terrifying books about this process. I have several, including The Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939-1945, which is an account of the German investigation into the atrocities against the German people in the East, and also against Wehrmacht soldiers during the war in the East. I have used Zayas' work on a couple of occasions. He does very good work. There's no question about it. However, he also has a long career as United Nations human rights official, and he champions international human rights secured by international bodies. So there's a bit of a conflict there. While he is culturally pro-German, he is anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler, and doesn't question the official version of the Holocaust. I'm not saying that he believes it, but he doesn't question it. And we can say that Paul Gottfried is the same. Why? I'm asking why these two men can't get past this. And this is what I'm going to answer in the rest of this segment, hopefully, if I can get it all in. So at issue tonight is the history presented in Gottfried's article, The Eternal German Guilt Trip. In the first half of the article, he comes out against collective guilt of the Germans for the so-called war crimes of World War II and how pathetic the Germans are for accepting it. He brings up for criticism the easy targets such as Marxist liberal Jürgen Habermas and Jew Jonah Goldhagen. He praises Jews Norman Finkelstein and Ruth Bettina Byrne for going after Goldhagen, but I say that's not a difficult thing to do, but they're given much credit for it. Now, the article, the first half of the article is very good. You know, I could enjoy that. It's the second half. He gets into what the Germans knew about the Holocaust, always spelled with the capital H. He introduces us to Desai's new book, which is called, I'll just give the English a translated title, Genocide as a State Secret, came out in 2011. He says that Zayas' previous books go against the prevalent leftist grain in Germany and that they're all painstakingly documented, as is this one, which is true. This book is based on, quote, the records and testimonies, unquote, of the Nuremberg trials in 1946-47 and interviews with surviving war criminals, including Albert Speer and Admiral Karl Dönitz, which, you know, they don't put war criminals in quotes, and the Nuremberg prosecutors, interviews with them too, and interviews with former war prisoners of the Nazis. Now, war prisoners of the Nazis would be those who were anti-Nazi, right? They would be the leftists again, no doubt, or some Jews. Going on, then he mentions records from the Wehrmacht Office for the Investigation of Violations of International Law and says there is nothing to suggest that these investigators knew about Hitler's final solution. He doesn't. He's got a capital F, capital S. Nothing, doesn't say alleged final solution. Doesn't put quotes around final solution. Final solution stands as something real. Then he says even the judges assigned to the Waffen-SS were often in the dark about the Einsatzgruppen's mission, and sometimes they launched inquiries into reports about mass murders taking place in the East. In other words, I'm saying these people were innocent. I'm saying these people were innocent and they had no knowledge of what was going on. That is the judges who were assigned to the Waffen-SS. Then he says even the regime's enemies, ranging from anti-Nazi aristocrats associated with the resistance to persecuted social democrats, such as the partly Jewish family of former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, and even former concentration camp inmates, had no idea of the final solution. So, again, he's wanting to say that people were unaware of it, except for these Nazis, top Nazis, or SS, or whatever, however that's going to come out, who were carrying it out. Then he says, according to the official story, Jews were being relocated and would be employed, and he puts relocated in quotes, as though that's a euphemism. He's going along with that, too. According to the official story, Jews were being, quote, relocated, unquote, and would be employed in, quote, work divisions, unquote, outside Germany. Although this forced evacuation caused some concern among friends and neighbors, what was happening did not look like the beginning of a genocide. So, you see, he's going along with that there's a final solution, that there was a genocide, that all of this happened, but the main... But most of the people were unaware of it, which is what she's going to want to say. So you can't blame them. What he's writing against is the same old thing that they're all doing, that people applaud them so much for. They're going against collective German guilt. Well, you know, for me, that's not going far enough at all. But I'll continue here. Then he writes that the reason for this was because secrecy was being observed. Now, does this come from Zayas, I ask, or from Gottfried's own knowledge? It probably comes from Zayas, from the book. He writes, the Holocaust was planned by a small circle meeting outside Berlin in January 1942. That's what really got my attention in this, because I was already thinking about the Wannsee Conference. And the small circle meeting outside Berlin in January 1942 is the Wannsee Conference, which he doesn't mention here, but he doesn't use those words, but that's what he means. And then he adds, in addressing his SS subordinates in Posen in 1943, Himmler boasted about how well their secret was being kept. Again, he's going along with the idea that Himmler was keeping a secret. Now, and I can't keep a straight face with this one, because Himmler, he says, this whole concept is that Himmler is boasting in this speech that he is having recorded about how well the secret is being kept. I mean, he's giving a speech before hundreds of men. Yes, okay, they're SS men or they're Nazis, but still, and it's being recorded. But he's saying in this speech how wonderful they're keeping the secret of exterminating Jews, supposedly. You know, I don't believe that that's what he was saying or meaning, but that's what the official thing is. And that's what Gottfried is saying, and Zayas, I imagine. So there's a lot of absurdity in this. Was Himmler an idiot that he would boast about how well their secret was being kept in a speech to a whole lot of people that's being recorded? I don't think so. But anyway, that's another issue. But then Gottfried writes, other factors work to keep the secret from getting out. So the whole thing is that this was a big secret. And revisionists have gone into whether this could have been a secret. But, you know, that and why it couldn't be a secret. They couldn't have kept it secret. But anyway, this is what Gottfried and Zayas are saying. He continues the death camps. So he's using the term death camps with no quotes around them, no alleged death camps or anything. He believes in the death camps, as opposed to generic concentration camps, were located in the East, not in Germany. Then from 1943 on, German civilians were subject to Allied bombing and had to protect themselves while enemy forces overran them. In this situation, it was unlikely that a war-weary German would wonder about a relocated Jewish neighbor's fate. This is interesting because the Allied bombing that I've just been reading to you about and have for three programs now, I think, or is it two? This bombing murdered thousands, but he doesn't even consider talking about that. He just sees that these Germans were trying to protect themselves. And for that reason, they shouldn't be blamed for not worrying about the Jews. Because once again, you know, even to the Jewish Paul Gottfried and the Cuban Alfred de Zayas, the Jews are what's most important. Continuing on, he writes, even foreign radio transmissions had little to say about the murdered Jews. He calls them the murdered Jews now. Germans who found out about the murders couldn't do much to stop them, since divulging the secret to a government official could be deadly. So nobody could divulge the secret, and most people didn't know, so on. Ironically, and this is still Gottfried, ironically, Zayas confirms findings about the Holocaust that came out of the Nuremberg trials. He confirms what came out of the Nuremberg trials. Although these trials were planned to make Germans feel ashamed of their country, the judges did not declare all Germans to be complicit in the Holocaust. It was assumed that the mass extermination of Jews, again, it's taken as a reality, was a carefully guarded secret. Very few of those put on trial were sentenced to death or to long imprisonment for planning to murder Jews. Even the prosecutors believed what Zayas tells us concerning knowledge of the final solution. Admittedly, there were isolated instances of Wehrmacht units participating in the shooting of Jews and other civilians, particularly in Kharkov and elsewhere in the Ukraine, but those were treated as special cases and not seen as typical of Wehrmacht behavior. This is still talking about the Nuremberg trials. So they didn't put every Wehrmacht soldier on trial and put him... you know, hang him too. They just looked for the leaders who kept the secret from all the others and so on and so forth. This is really not a very good kind of, if this is the best they can do in 2012, so long after this war, if this is the best kind of revisionism they can come up with, you know, I'm not impressed with it. And what bothers me is that so many people who supposedly are Holocaust wise and on our side and even revisionists and so on will pass this article around and think it's just wonderful. You know, I don't know. They read the first few paragraphs, which sound good, and then they don't worry about the ending of it, where all this stuff comes in. Anyway, finally he ends with, quote, "It speaks volumes that Zayas, who echoes the post-war Nuremberg trial view, of who knew what about the Holocaust, is now regarded in some circles as a German apologist." Well, yes. No matter what, even if you go a tiny little way in trying to defend the Germans, you will be considered that in some circles. They won't accept it. But my attention is on why Zayas and Paul Gottfried accept the Nuremberg trial view. So going on with Gottfried, it is, as I said, that they don't want to allow. Now, is this me or is this him? This must be me. Oh, this is me. Okay, that's the end of Gottfried's article. At least the end of what I think that's the end of it. So my conclusions here, my summing up and my view is that why they do this? Why do they do this? They don't want, and I'm so familiar with this. I run into this all the time. The people like Zayas and Paul Gottfried don't want to allow Nazism to resurface, just as the whole global framework in place today doesn't want it to. And it's fanatically determined that it won't. And these people, of course, don't want to go so far that they're going to be banned and they're going to have their books trashed and they're not going to be able to function, even though they're under suspicion now. But they're still able to function in the marketplace. But if there's that, but I think there's more to it. It's their politics. They are on the liberal. Gottfried calls himself a paleoconservative, but he also they don't want any form. They're afraid of racism. They're afraid of racial thinking, and they don't want anything like that. So they want to keep everything to do with the National Socialists, Adolf Hitler, and so on. Bad. You know, they'll keep trashing it. They'll keep beating on it. They'll never accept it because of this political persuasion that they have. So I don't see the point of praising these people, because this is, as I've made clear to many times, this is always where I see where somebody's coming from based on what they think about this. But, I want to say that the vast majority, truthfully, of people would be much happier and better off under some form of Nazism, as Adolf Hitler demonstrated, than they are under today's democratic forms of government, which are all under Jewish control via being indebted to Jewish money and mentally imprisoned by Jewish media. The people were well off under Adolf Hitler. All right. Non-Germans in Germany were not so well off, but, that's all you can say. That it was just, and Jews were wanting to be deported. Oh, if we can talk about what Jews do, what they're doing to us now, we ought to say that if we had a leader, if we had a president who would announce, he's going to set up some commissions to decide how to get the Jews out of power in the United States, we could all celebrate. You know, wouldn't we all be celebrating? Well, we could set off the fireworks. We'd be so happy. That's what Adolf Hitler did. Now, let's remember that, once again, Gottfried is Jewish. As much as he hangs out with the white, pro-white people. And Alfred de Zayas is Cuban, even though he's probably more white than Gottfried. He looks white. He's a good-looking guy, and he is a very cultured and intelligent person, and he has a great record of accomplishment. But, he was born Cuban. That's all I can say. He's probably Spanish. He's probably pretty much white Spanish. But they are afraid of a Hitler revision, though, let alone a rehabilitation. You know, they don't want, let alone a rehabilitation. They don't even want any revision for that reason. They're biased in their view and in their interpretation of history, and they stay stuck there. But I've made my point here. Now, when I come back, ladies and gentlemen, for the second hour, Christine Miller is going to join me. And I want to invite you to call in if you want to in the second hour, but not right away because I have to introduce my guests and we have to talk a little bit. We're going to go into the VANSI conference, the protocol. I've got a lot to say about that. I'm sure she does too, and we'll fill up that hour. The number to call is 1-855-477-2283. Be back in a moment.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The owners of the Costa Concordia cruise liner say the ship's captain ran aground after making what they call an unapproved, unauthorized deviation in the vessel's course. Captain Francesco Schettino has denied charges that he abandoned the cruise liner before it was evacuated. He also denies any culpability in the deaths of six passengers in the disaster. At least a dozen more remain missing after the liner hit a submerged rock just off the coast of Tuscany. Captain Schettino told Italian television that the rock wasn't marked on any of his charts. He speaks here through an interpreter.
In the nautical chart, it was marked just as water at some 100 to 150 meters from the rocks, and we were about 300 meters from the shore, more or less. We shouldn't have had this contact.
Fran Golden, a contributing editor for Budget Travel magazine, says there are many questions for the inquiry into the accident to answer.
Why weren't the watertight container doors closed? There are procedures that would be followed if a lot of water was coming into the ship that should have prevented a ship from tipping over and basically sinking.
John Huntsman, a former U.S. ambassador to China, has dropped out of the race for the Republican Party's presidential nomination. After performing poorly in the New Hampshire primary election 1 week ago, the opinion polls suggested that he was going to have a tough time breathing new life into his campaign. Addressing his support in South Carolina, which holds its primary this coming weekend, he urged them to back the front runner in the Republican race, Mitt Romney.
Today, I am suspending my campaign for the presidency. I believe it is now time for our party to unite around the candidate best equipped to defeat Barack Obama. Despite our differences and the space between us on some of the issues, I believe that candidate is Governor Mitt Romney.
And Mitt Romney now enjoys a 20-point advantage over his remaining rivals in Saturday's South Carolina primary. Israel is accusing Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg of gratuitous bashing after he accused the government in Tel Aviv of undermining the prospects for a comprehensive peace agreement. Mr. Clegg was speaking after a Downing Street meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. He called the construction of Israeli settlements an act of deliberate vandalism and said the Israeli building projects were doing immense damage to the peace process.
The risk is that you just get material, physical facts on the ground which make it impossible to deliver at some point in the future the two-state solution, which everybody agrees is the only viable way forward for the region.
Don't forget, you can follow our reporting online at fsnreportersblog.com. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Two key
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're in our second hour now, and as I told you, this is the call-in hour, and if in a 15 minutes or 20 minutes or so, if you have an urge to call and ask a question or make a brief comment, the number is 1-855-477-2283. Now, I'm going to introduce my guest, Christine Miller. First, I want to say a few words about her. She's a lovely lady who I like very much. And she has just, she writes things for now for the First Freedom newspaper. You know, I had Olaf Childress on in December, and I like him very much too. And I got my first issue. I subscribe to his newspaper. It comes out once a month. It's, how many pages is it? It's 20 some or so. And it's full of stuff. And anyway, this one had an article that was something that Christine Miller translated from the German. The title is The Von C. Protocol, Forgery of the Century. And I thought this was just the thing to talk about because I realized afterwards that we're coming up to the 70th anniversary of that so-called meeting, which will be on January 20th. So, hello, Christine. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, I know it's taken me a while to get to you, but you have a website, and I want people to know about it. It's at cbmiller.com, right? And it contains a lot of letters to the editor and essays that you have written. Is that correct?
Yes. But by the way, I want to update the website, so it will take me maybe another week, and then all the articles and the letters which aren't there yet, they will be put there. I will put them there. So it will take me about a week to update it. I'm not computer literate, and I need some help. But I want to do that. Anything else?
Is the one of them is the letters and the essays and so on that similar to what's on your website and has more than that in it though. And the other one is a book by your the diary or war log of your father who was on the Eastern Front.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, I'm not going to. I'm going to put my letters, which are not there. I think the last letter I put there was from 1997. Okay, so I have many more letters written in the meanwhile, and they are going to be put on that website. But I'm not going to put my father's diary on there. I think that would be a little bit too difficult for me to do.
So, yes, and if people would like, it's a wonderful book. I have that book. And if people would like to purchase that book, which you only charge like $10, I think you said, to mail it to people. Yeah. Maybe you've gone up. Maybe you should charge 15 or 20, I've told you.
But sometimes if you are too cheap, people think it's not worth anything.
Yes, that's what I told you.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, yeah.
Would you give out your email address so that if people want to write you and ask you about it and get your mailing address from you, they can do that?
Okay. My email address is millercbm@gmail.com.
Oh, now it's at Gmail.
Yes.
Now, it's not at MSN.
No, I changed. Okay. Once more, millercbm@gmail.com.
Okay. All right. Very good. Now let's talk about the Von C. Protocol. The only thing I'm familiar with is the work that's done by Johannes Fay that is called shoot, it's called something else. It's not called Forgery of the Century, but this is, I think, is the same book that you've taken this from.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Well, what did you take your translation from?
That translation came from a German publication, Huttenbriefe, and it is by Mr. Ney, N-N-E-Y.
Yes, right. Well, you know, on the Kodo, at www.kodo.com, there is the paper by Johannes Peter Ney. It's called The WANSI Conference Protocol, Anatomy of a Fabrication. That's how it's translated here. And I think it's the same thing that you went by.
It must be, yes.
Right. It's available to people if they want to go there and look for it. It's under Foundations of Contemporary History. But, the thing I want to tell the listeners about the WANSI protocol, and I want to come out with my conclusions right in the beginning, because I might not get to them at the end. And then I want you to say, to tell us, what considerations you've come to from the work you've done on it. But first, I looked up the word forgery to make sure that forgery was the right word to be used. Uh-huh. And the archaic definition is invention, which is very good. And the modern definition is it's falsely and fraudulently making or altering a document. And that's exactly what I think has been done with this so-called WANSI protocol. It's not just been changed. It's probably been made up altogether. Some people think it was just doctored, but they had to come up with totally new documents. So they very likely was just done. It was just invented. Now, the background on this comes from Robert Kempner. Now you're familiar with Robert Kempner.
Right.
Yeah.
He was an accuser. Okay. He produced it. He submitted it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He says he found it. Now let's let people know he was an assistant. He's a German born Jew. He was born in Germany and he was some kind of an investigator or a police person or a lawyer, and he participated in the investigation and prosecution of Adolf Hitler and Wilhelm Frick in 1924. I didn't know that until today. Then he was fired by Goering for, not being loyal. And then he was deported by Wilhelm Frick later for being, he was in a concentration camp for about a year. Then he was deported from the country because he was engaging in anti-regime activities. So then he went to the United States, and after the end of the war, he came back with all those there's a whole slew of them.
Yes.
Back. And they were able to get revenge.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, it's amazing, you know, how the Americans brought all the Jews back to Germany. And boy, did they ever lord it over the Germans. And so Kempner was one of them.
Yeah, he was a particularly bad one and a particularly capable one. And he was a part of the Nuremberg team under Telford Taylor. And he was an interrogator and assistant prosecutor at the main Nuremberg trial. And he was allowed to interrogate Hermann Goering and Wilhelm Frick, the two men who had who had gotten rid of him. So he had a lot of desire to get back at them. And then the WANSI protocol sort of came out a little bit in that trial. And then in the so-called Wilhelmstrasse trial, or the Ministries, it's Ministries trial, also known as Wilhelmstrasse trial, that began in November 1947 and ended in November 1948. He was the chief prosecutor at that one, and that's when the protocol was discussed more, and he presented his documents that he had found. So where did he find these, Christine?
What did you? When did he find or where?
No, where? Where?
He never told. That he just had them. Okay, he didn't. That was never discussed where and when he found them.
It is. He said that. It is very misty and shadowy, and it's hard to get this information. But he said that he, in two occasions, he talked about this, and they contradict each other. On the one, he said that he was expecting a shipment of documents from Berlin in early March 1947. I think this was during the trial time. And among these, he had some of his assistants, whatever, going through all these boxes and piles of documents that the Americans had.
Caroline, a question. Where did you get that information from? I was looking for
this. This is in Ney.
Okay.
Johannes Ney. And he says that he discovered, actually one of his assistants discovered it and told him about it, a transcript of the Wannsee conference. And that he claimed that the author of this, a transcript, which he called minutes of the meeting, was Adolf Eichmann. But then, and that's where it was. But then in 1983, during a taped radio interview, he said that he discovered it in autumn 1947. But these are, according to Ney, the only two statements that have ever been heard, and there's no documentation verifying the place and circumstances of the discovery, which is what you said is true.
It's just my God, I found something out now. You know much more about it than I do.
Well, okay. I've been deeply researching for 3 days. I'm telling you, and I want to tell the listeners that this is like everything to do with the Holocaust and with everything to do with World War II and so on. That you go searching for the origin of these things that are widely believed and seem to be, totally, they must be documented, there must be something about them. And I go looking and I look and I finally, find some little something, but it's like, there's nothing there. There's nothing behind any of this. This is why I say it's all a hoax, because when you get down to, try to find something that would confirm the beginning of it or confirm it in some way, it doesn't exist. Yeah. So, and that's what I found with this.
But what I want to see about what bothers me about, first of all, it's supposed to be minutes, and actually these minutes are not signed. They do not follow German bureaucratic procedures. Okay, so they are not minutes. Okay. Then I read, maybe they were written from memory, but the whole thing is just, it's all nebulous,
Yes.
Nothing is defined. And something which I think really is absolutely ridiculous. I read through it. And again, there's nothing in there really. It's all, the whole thing, what they call protocol, is innately contradictory. On one hand, they want to use the Jews to resettle them, and then it's a hodgepodge, and it doesn't follow a clear line. And naturally, one thing which I really think is absolutely ridiculous, to use this as a basis for the planning of the genocide. I mean, these are not even, it's secondary people, not the main honchos, not Hitler, not Goering, not Hess. I mean, wouldn't you think that that they would have, if the genocide was planned, it would have been planned at the very top, and not by a conference?
Yeah, well, some people, believers, try to say that, it was already planned by the top people, by Hitler, and then it came down to these secondary people who were supposed to plan out how it was going to take place, which is, of course, stupid.
That is ridiculous, but mm-hmm. Again, the point is they don't have anything from the top people. So they go to secondary people.
Well, sure. It follows the same rules that all this Holocaust so-called evidence follows.
Yeah, and you know something else, you know, with Final Solution, you know, they simply take an expression like Final Solution and say, so the Final Solution really meant genocide. But darn it, if I have a final solution to a problem or a complete solution to a problem, that doesn't mean I kill it.
Well, you know, now speaking of that, in the protocol itself, which I say is a total fake, but I'll get into that. But it says total solution, and in the letters preceding. If any time that's used, there's no final solution. It says total solution, but then they change it. They've changed it to final solution.
Yes. So it was so apparently Göring objected to during the Nuremberg war crime trials to the end what in German was Endlösung, the final solution. He said no, it was never final solution. It was Gesamtlösung. And as you just mentioned, total, a complete solution,
mm-hmm.
okay, not
right.
final. But right. but again, you know, they just take a, have you ever read Hilberg, The Destruction of the European Jews?
Well, I've read Jürgen Graf's critique of it, and I've read a lot about it.
Yeah, I read the whole book.
And good for you.
Can I mention something about that? That is supposed to be the main book, okay. Very well regarded by everybody who believes in the Holocaust. But what Hilberg said, said no document was ever found to give an order. And then Hilberg said, that was a meeting of minds. They understood each other. But you can't, how many people can you kill by meeting of minds? You have to have an order. You have to have something. What mm-hmm. officer... Okay, would execute somebody without having an order? I mean, that whole thing is preposterous. And naturally, I don't know if you know that, but Hilberg wrote in his writes about an incident how the Jews were killed. And since the dark ditches, and then naturally the Jews were put into ditches, okay? They killed Jews. But, the fat of the Jews, which collected at the bottom of the ditches, were used to pour over the bodies.
Yes. Well, that's some of those crazy stories.
To hasten incineration. But what this good man does, he confuses two processes. He confuses roasting with burning.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Okay, I'm going to get back to the Wannsee, and I just want to put out four major points of what I think we can show about what's wrong with it. And one, the first one, which we've talked about some of this, how the documents were found remains unclear. No satisfactory explanation. We've talked about that. But I do want to say that It is said in Steve Lehrer's book. He wrote a book. He's Jewish, of course, and it's a book to promote the whole thing. It's called Wannsee House and the Holocaust. But he says in there that the first allusion to the Wannsee Conference appeared in the diaries of Hans Frank, Hitler's governor general of Poland.
Yes.
And Frank mentioned Bühler as his representative. Well, I looked for this diary entry and what was said. And if there was anything there, you know, it would be somewhere. And I looked through all kinds of writers and so on. And they mentioned this. But it was also said that that these diaries of Hans Frank were 10,000 pages. But it wasn't a real diary. It was a record made by his secretaries and stenographers of his conferences, receptions, and other official functions. So it's possible that in there was a notation for a meeting in January in at Wannsee or in Berlin. He marked that he was sending his assistant Bühler. I don't think I have his first name written down here, but he was his main man there, to that in his place. So, but it's never given. It's never quoted, you know, anywhere. So you don't know, but I just assume that maybe they found something like that in there, but it's not worth quoting. So, that is kind of a big fake thing. The other thing is Goering's letter that was presented at Nuremberg IMT in which he invited, he charged Heydrich with coming up with the plan. With coming up with the plan. And this letter could be, I mean, this could have happened, but this letter is also full of errors and strange things and presents itself as a forgery.
Yeah. But again, in this letter which I read, I have Steglitz, I have the book by Steglitz, you know, the Auschwitz myth. Mm-hmm. And he has that letter in there, and in this letter it says nothing about the genocide. I mean, have you?
Well,
read
that's
the
right. Well, no, yes, it's perfectly innocent letter, and everybody agrees to that. He just says come up with a plan of how we're going to deport the Jews. That's all. You know,
it's a perfectly innocent letter.
To come up with a total plan, a total solution. A total solution.
It's some solution.
Yes. German, for you to know German so you can, know what these words mean.
But, you know, again, you know, when anybody reading, if you give that letter to somebody who doesn't and don't tell that it was written by Goering, I mean, that person would consider that a completely innocent letter.
Yes. So we can put that aside. But now during the Nuremberg trial, both Hans Frank and his assistant Bühler were cooperating with the Allies. They were. You know, Frank, it's known that Frank he just did everything for him, and he blamed himself, he blamed the Germans. He accepted everything and he was wanting to reaffirm himself with his Catholic faith, and he knew he was going to go to the gallows. And Bühler was also cooperating, maybe because Frank, he didn't have any choice, or maybe because he thought he might get let off, but he ended up being hung too. But the thing is that they say that, Bühler acknowledged being present at the conference. In 1946, he did that.
Yeah. The names are listed. Is his name listed? You know,
yes,
I don't remember
this. Yes. Yeah, he's one of them. The names are all listed. Now, my position at this point is that there may have been a meeting, and you said that too, just an ordinary meeting, not anything big, not any big special meeting, but some kind of a meeting. Since all these documents are forgeries, there may even not have been a meeting, but there are some people who are listed on there, Germans, who later on said that they were at that meeting and it didn't have anything to do with what it said to have to do, but they do say that they were at that meeting. Now, but one of them says that Heydrich was giving a talk about this and that. Now, I want to bring up Heydrich because the evidence is very strong that he was not in Berlin on January
20th, 1942.
Mm, I didn't know that. Yeah, and I want to go into that. I guess so. We're almost to our half-hour break, so I'll wait until we come back. But I want to go into that because he had a very big deal going on in Prague. You know, he was the Czech, rights protector for the Czech people. And there was a lot going on there, and it's very unlikely that he could have been at this big gala affair on the night of January 20th and been spent the afternoon at this Wannsee conference. So we'll talk about that when we come back. So hang on, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Diplomats have confirmed Iran's begun enriching uranium at a brand new nuclear facility. The West has slammed the move as a provocation at a time when brinksmanship between the U.S. and Iran has reached boiling point. Let's now get some more on this from Patrick Henderson, associate editor from Infowars.com. Thank you for coming on the program today. Before we get into the issue of uranium enrichment with Iran, the latest angle I want to take with you is this. As we know, for the past week or so, in fact, it was 10 days in the very recent past, Iran was staging naval military war games in the Gulf. We're now hearing the U.S. and Israel are gearing up for joint military exercises in the Gulf as well. It's just as Tehran announces it will shortly stage what it's calling, quote, the greatest war games ever seen in the region. Who's pushing who here, do you think?
You know what? This looks vaguely familiar to power politics and power geopolitics that we saw pre-1991. I'm talking about the Cold War, Rory. Look, the main subject here we're looking at is we saw in the last week a direct reaction in the world oil markets. We saw prices spike. Price of oil per barrel is going up, okay? This is real creation of wealth for the oil industry. I do not see the timetable right now with Iran as being on schedule for a preemptive attack from the United States and or Israel. I see this as drawing out over a longer period.
All right, now let's go back to the issue of diplomats confirming Iran has begun enriching uranium at a brand new nuclear facility. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's unable to verify that Iran's nuclear program remains peaceful. Why then has Tehran decided to push ahead with launching this new facility, which experts say could produce pre-weapons-grade uranium?
Well, again, this all depends on your perspective. If you're an expert from the International Atomic Energy Agency or the UN, you'll see this as a possible move towards building a nuclear weapon. If you're an expert from a neutral party, you might see it as something in, with regards to nuclear power. Also, you have to not ignore the fact that part of Iran's industrial nuclear program has to do with the medical industry, okay? Iran is pushing forward to be a leader in technology as far as medicine and pharmaceuticals, and also this is a base requirement to do some of this kind of activity industrially, okay? So we can't ignore that, like any other country would pursue such an ambition.
So as we've seen, Iran conducting 10 days of naval exercises in the Gulf, the West and the International Atomic Agency bearing down on Tehran over its nuclear ambitions. The Iranian president is currently visiting his allies in South America. How much international support does Iran really have at this point? And how is that affecting the situation in the Gulf region? Is it becoming more isolated, possibly?
I think the idea...
We'll be right back.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I'm back with Christine Miller, my guest, and we are talking about the Von C protocol and whether there was ever really a meeting on that, let alone even just possibly just a minor meeting. Now, I'm going to just go ahead in the beginning here and go through this material on Heydrich. And my question is, where was Heydrich on January 20th? Well, yeah. There's no date on the protocol, so we don't know actually who wrote it, and there's no official markings, and Heydrich is not listed as chairman or as being present. So he's not listed on there. Now, he was supposed to have set the whole meeting up, and he was supposed to have invited everybody, and because Goering wanted him to do something about making a plan, you know. So this was the response to that. And there were two invitation letters that are also very strange and like forgeries. But now, here's the thing. He was the Reich protector of Bohemian Moravia, and the new Czech government was inaugurated on January 20th, 1942, with a reception at the Hradčin. That's some kind of a palace or government building, fancy one, at 7 yes. p.m. Okay.
At Prague?
Yes, in Prague.
Okay, I know what you're talking about.
The Hradčin, how do you pronounce that?
Don't know.
That's Czech. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Now, here's the thing. He was there at 7 p.m. He had to be there. This was very important. This is a big deal. And he was also supposed to be at this meeting in Von C at 12 noon. The meeting was called for 12 noon. And it was, believers say, it was a very important meeting, and it would lasting about 3 hours, followed by breakfast. So at 3 p.m., they were going to have breakfast. And then it says there's some strange stuff here. Now I'm going to skip down here a little further about, why he had to be at that meeting. He was involved in a leading role in the reforming of the government in Prague on now this is from a book by, Wolf Dieter Rotta. He says the main actor, Reinhold Heydrich, on January 19th, 1942, the day before, the negotiations about the reforming of the government had been concluded, and the government could be presented to the public, which was going to happen then the next day. And here's another quote from there. The proclamation by the new government of the protectorate was a personal draft of Heydrich, which he put across to Moravec, who told Kreitze that it was his work. Kreitze's draft had been rejected by the Reich Protector, and Heydrich reported that to Berlin that all was promising. So this was very important. He had played a big role in this. He was there on the 19th in these negotiations, and then he was there at 7 p.m. for the big gala affair. Mm-hmm. Now, supposedly, though, he traveled to back to Berlin in the afternoon, and he spent the afternoon at this also very important conference, you know, giving this talk. And
did you know, where did you find all of this?
Okay.
That's interesting.
Well, now here's a quote from Robert Kempner from a book he wrote, I guess. It's something called Antike einer Epoche. Epoch.
Epoche? Okay.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Say the first sentence, the first word.
A-N-K-I-G-E-R.
A-N-K-I-G-E-R.
Or is it K-L? K-L. Angler. Einer Epic. Okay. Anyway, the quote is, this was a big occasion. This is Robert Kempner talking about the Von C conference. He's talking about the Von C. This was a big occasion. One had to drive out to Von C with the car. Heard it was snowing and slippery, he said. This was in some interview he had. And then, as we later found out, he says, Eichmann spent some time with Heydrich following the conference, sipping cognac. Now, apparently Eichmann told Captain Honor Less this at the Jerusalem trial. You know, of course, once Eichmann was in Jerusalem, he was saying anything and everything, whatever they wanted him to say. And he thought he was going to get off. I mean, he thought he was going to have life. He didn't think they were going to hang him. And he, you know, but they did. They were leading him to believe that. So he was cooperating and going along. Anyway, this writer, and I'm not sure if this is Staglick or someone else, but he says, Heydrich have scheduled two important events so close together in January when bad weather was possible. Oh, that's me. That's my comment. It's more likely he was not there or that it was a short meeting. And after his few remarks, he left. The first is more likely. Well, actually, another thing that's likely is that he sent a message and it was read. You know, if that's a possibility too.
But you know,
he's not listed as being present. Yeah. You know, and he could, if there was a meeting, and if any of this is true, then that could have happened. But the fact that the idea that he was there is hard to believe. It's not likely at all.
Yeah, it's not in Staglich, so you must have found that information someplace else. But anyhow, what I want to say, you know, Nancy, you know, Carolyn, I mean, there are so many government meetings. I mean, look at our government. They always have meetings. Mm-hmm. So it could have been any old meeting, and so.
I agree with you. After looking into all this, I think that if there was a meeting, it was just an ordinary meeting because they've said, and I have some more information if I can find it from somebody who was there, Dr. Liebrandt. And he said that he was a minister, and he was the last surviving person who was at that meeting. he said there was a meeting, and he was at it, but he could have confused it with a different meeting or a different day. You know, he died at the beginning of his 80th year, and in these last years, he was talking about this. So, you know, our memories aren't that good, really. But he said that that they had these ministers' meetings every month. And this one was just set in Wannsee, but I don't know, you know, if it was in January. You know, it seems like if there might be weather problems, but in any event, that's where it was, and according to him, and it was just an ordinary kind of ministers' meeting. It was nothing special.
But I mean, that is my feeling. I mean, as I said, you know, even in Marshfield, they have always have meetings. I mean, I even can count them how many meetings they have. So a completely innocent, you know, meeting, you know, they make that into the big.
Oh sure, yeah. They've this Kempner. I think that Kempner made up the story that he found these documents.
Yes.
Because he's not clear. It's very vague, and you know he doesn't put out any good information on it. And he had these documents made up, and we're going to talk about what these documents look like now. But I'll just say real quick that Ernst Nolte, who's a well-known German historian who is just a little bit more, little open to revisionism, but he's not a real revisionist.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And he has said that, Deborah Lipstadt said that he claimed in one of his books that the Wannsee Conference of 1942 never happened, and that the minutes were post-war forgeries. Well, he may not have claimed it outright. He may have suggested the possibility, but you know that's Deborah Lipstadt.
I know.
Changing him around.
Yeah.
But let's go through these. We already talked about Göring's letter, and that's that shows. Well, even that, which could be perfectly okay, it's missing. There's no letterhead on it. It's a typed-in sender's address is incorrect, and the date is incomplete, missing the day. There's no reference number, no distributor of the given, and there's no line with the identifying RE. You know what the subject is, and then the linguistic content. Well, Göring himself. objected to it when they read it to him.
Yes.
He said he wouldn't write that way. It was very poor German. All right, so there's that. Now there was a first and a second invitation letter from Heydrich. And it's the same kind of things. This is just typed on plain paper. It says on this first one, the top secret is missing. It's a letter took 24 days from the date they have on the letter, November 29th, 1941. It wasn't received until December 23rd, 1941. So it's almost a month. And this was postal route within Berlin.
Yeah,
now, it is. Now, right there, you see. Now, these are all signs. We should tell the listeners that all these signs of forgery should have been taken into account in the court, you know, the military tribunal or any of these tribunals. I mean, this is what's supposed to be done. You don't just accept documents without any question about them, you know, without looking at them. Documents, and this is a point that this NEY makes very strongly, that documents have to be studied. They have to be verified of that they're what they say they are. And none of these are. And they were just accepted and passed on through.
But naturally, what Ney also says, you know, is that there are two different versions of the documents. Of the 16. Okay. One has two S's for SS, and one has the lightning sign.
Yeah. This is the protocol itself, right?
Yes.
And you show images of the top of the page. Of the first page of the protocol, of the two different copies that are in extant, one is supposed to be a copy of the other, isn't it? And yet they're not exactly the same.
No, one is not supposed to be a copy of the other. No, they are just one was apparently submitted first, and then the other one was submitted. Well, they just exist these two versions.
You mean they're supposed to both be the copy 16?
Both are supposed to be copy 16s. So what Ney says, okay, the first one, which has the two SS's, okay, that was the first forgeries. And then, because at this time they didn't have a typewriter which had the two lightning signs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In all the SS offices, they had this typewriter with this key.
Sure.
Okay. So they made the first forgery, and then they realized, so they put out a second forgery after they had gotten hold of a typewriter, of an SS typewriter, with that key.
Oh, well, now that's really stupid.
Carolyn, it can't be stupid enough. It's believed. I mean, that's a problem.
Well, I know. I have a listener who emailed me. I want to say what he emailed me right now. Yeah, a fellow from Britain. He wrote me today. He said, after getting my mailing on this program, he said, "Dear Carolyn, how can anyone doubt that the conference took place? There are even two originals of the letter of transmittal of the minutes, one now shown at the Wannsee Institute and the other published by Robert Kempner in his book, in the name of the book." Then he says, "They are practically identical, so it must be true."
No, they are not identical.
He said they are practically identical. I thought that was funny.
Yes, but again,
they're not. What he's saying is that they're not identical. But if they're practically identical, that's okay. That's good enough.
No, they are not identical. You know, Carolyn, the devil is in the detail.
Exactly, and with documents, it has to be.
It's in the detail again. So they have two. Okay, they are two versions of 16s. But there are two versions of it. It's just like with the Anne Frank diary. You know, when you write a diary, okay, you have one version. You don't have three versions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it is the same thing with the Wannsee protocols. There are two versions of number 16.
Yeah, and there were 30, supposedly 30 There were only 15 minister, but they made 30 copies. But the only one that survived is this number 16, which Kempner says he found.
Yes.
But then somehow...
Two versions of number 16.
Okay. I thought that the one was supposed to be a copy of the other, so no.
No. It's two different versions.
Okay. Well, that cannot be.
No, I mean,
And you have that SS symbol, they have it sometimes and other times they don't have it. That's very telling.
Yeah, in the first Naysing said the first falsification, they didn't have a typewriter yet with that key. So they simply used SS of a standard typewriter. Then when they got hold of a typewriter, when they got an SS typewriter with the key, they produced a second version.
Okay, and that's very good. Now we can go back to the protocol, but before we do, let's look at the accompanying letter with the protocol that was sent out to all these people who supposedly were there. And it's called a protocol, which means minutes. But it is said that it's not minutes, and you brought this up earlier. It's just like, and this is what a couple of people, of these people who have written about it said, it's like notes taken afterward. After it was over, somebody wrote up what took place. It wasn't somebody taking minutes while they were sitting there during the meeting. Yeah.
Right.
So the whole thing is named wrong. Naturally. Now,
right.
The accompanying
exactly.
letter cannot be genuine because it's dated January 26, 1942, with a reference number that would have to have been registered at the office of the Chief of Security Police in the SD before the protocol that it was to accompany. So, you know, the timing is way off. It shows a reference number that has already been used, too, that doesn't fit the date of January 26th. I mean, the numbers in the office.
Yes.
I get a little hard. It's a little hard for me to see what they're saying about this, but that's what it means. And then 35 days, as we said, between the date of the letter and its arrival, and then it has these handwritten comments on it. This was written to Luther. This particular copy was one that was sent to Luther, supposedly Martin Luther. He's somebody who worked in the Foreign Office, a minister. And a handwritten comment is added. And let's see, he wrote something on it after he got it. And he dated it with, he put a date on his comment. And it's dated to February, means the month of February, which means that it was received before, let's see, how does this go? The letter was, to this letter, even before it was received by the Correspondence Department of the Foreign Office, because it's dated with the month to February. I don't have that clear in my head, but that's something that's a problem. Now, it also bears a rubber stamp showing that its receipt at the Foreign Office with the certain reference number had already been assigned to a different document. So it has a reference number that can't be, that doesn't work.
It doesn't fit the document.
No. And it's missing the sender's address, which is normally printed on the stationery, but this is just done on an ordinary piece of paper. And the new meeting place, Kurfürstenstrasse, which was in that, which...
In Berlin?
Yeah, they, in his, he had to change the meeting. Anyway, they don't use the proper SS in that. It's spelled with an SS rather than
the lightning sign.
No, not the lightning sign. It's just the German way of making that SS looks like
the SS, right.
Yeah.
But you know, as I said, the SS had typewriters with that lightning key.
Yeah, but this is the Foreign Office.
Okay, Foreign Office would be different then.
Yeah.
But go on.
But the sender's, Yeah. Eichmann, okay, the sender's reference number, 4B4, indicates Eichmann's office, but Eichmann used stationery which had his identifier already printed on it, and the letterhead is different from that of the two letters of invitation, so they don't all match up. And then the letter lacks array line two and a distributor. And there's a place to put in the number of copies, but that's left blank. And there's no mention of the 30 copies. And the space to indicate enclosures is also left blank. Okay. And also someone has criticized that there were no undersecretaries of state, and they use that word in this accompanying letter. Unterstaatssekretär at the German Foreign Office, but he said that wasn't used. So the point is, then there's all this linguistic content, bad German and so on. So the point is that there are so many things wrong with this that it could not have been sent out by Eichmann or by Heydrich or by any of those people.
But Carolyn, it no matter how primitive the forgery is. By the way, I tell you what you should do, Caroline. You should. I have a whole slew of forged pictures. You should give it. We should talk about these forged pictures. I mean, and these pictures.
Oh yes,
are forged,
yes, I know. But that's a different. Let's not go into that now because we've only got 4 minutes left.
But I just want to say that the forgery, it doesn't matter how primitive it is. I mean, they didn't put very much effort into their forgeries. They make it as crude, as primitive, because they knew they had the judges on their side, so it didn't matter. They didn't have to put any care into these forgeries.
Well, they probably did do them as the best they could. They tried to do a good job, but they didn't have everything they needed. And
right.
So they did it anyway, because they just
couldn't
have it.
Yes.
You know, so.
Exactly.
And then it talks about the slip up. And I think in what you were talking about the two different versions, and on these two different, versions of the protocol, they have the things, the first page that there's, things are in the wrong, things are not in the same place. So when you compare them, they've tried to put them in the same place. You have these two pictures in your article. They've tried to put them in the same place, but it's impossible when somebody's copying something that they're maybe looking at and trying to copy it on a typewriter, not with a copy machine, that some things are not going to be right. And this is what gives it away.
Yeah, but as I said, it doesn't seem to matter because they don't have to be careful. So
here's my section on why does it work and why does it continue to be believed? And as we know, it's the constant repetition of the allegation that the Wannsee Conference represented the act of planning the genocide of the Jews. You know, as the media has put that into people's consciousness,
Caroline, don't forget the movie, the film, the
media. Yes.
The image, the picture, the movie was very important to cement it.
And they've turned this building into
a museum.
A museum,
yes.
and school classes are being led through the rooms.
Yes,
and
yes.
They're told all this stuff when they're young, and and they're told all these terrible stories, and they believe it. So this is why it continues.
But the Englishman what he said was to me very interesting. What did he say again about the two versions? But
there are two originals, and they're practically identical.
Practically. But that's where the whole, as I said, the devil is in the detail. Practically, so they are not the same. attempt.
Well, that's what the revisionists have been saying. And
yes.
But it's even so, an awful lot of people who don't believe in the Holocaust and who are Holocaust revisionists, but not maybe as far, they don't go as far as you and I, but they'll believe a lot of it. They'll believe that this whole meeting took place and everything was done as they say, except that the protocol shows that it wasn't anything about actual extermination. It was about deporting the Jews. But, you know, I go further than that, and I like to, there's less likelihood that much of it took place. Listen, thank you, Christine.
Okay, take care, Caroline. Lots of fun.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.